Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We've taken control of Iran's airspace and waterways without boots on the ground. We control their fate. But when a few drones get through, or tragic things happen, it's front page news. I get it, the press only wants to make the president look bad, but try for once to report the reality.
Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, who President Trump calls Secretary of War, criticizes journalists for covering U.S. casualties. And Senate Republicans block a war powers resolution that asserts Congress's role in declaring war. We'll speak with two former U.S. government officials, an 18-year career diplomat who resigned from the State Department, a former Pentagon advisor. Then, as Russian-Ukraine peace talks are halted in Geneva because of the Iran war, we'll speak to filmmaker Craig Renaud, brother of Brent, the first Western journalist killed by Russian forces in Ukraine 4 years ago.
We've just got some breaking news. Brent Renaud, an American photojournalist, has been killed.
Brent lost his life documenting the horrors of the battlefield in Ukraine.
But first, a conversation with the acclaimed documentary filmmaker Geeta Gandhabir. She's made history for being nominated for both Best Documentary Short and Best Documentary Feature for an Oscar.
911
said
the emergency.
Are you having problems with the neighbor's children?
I'm at a sheriff's office. Were any of you guys
ever here messing
with this lady? No. We were playing football.
Sheriff's office.
I called because the kids live across the street. They shouldn't be screaming and running around.
Okay.
All the kids like to play softball. They can't walk or even throw their football over here.
911, what is the address of the emergency?
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United States Senate rejected a resolution Wednesday that would have directed the removal of U.S. armed forces from hostilities with Iran, as Iran's government said the death toll from joint U.S.-Israeli attacks passed 1,200. 52 Republicans were joined by Pennsylvania Democratic Senator John Fetterman on a procedural vote opposing the war powers resolution. This is Mississippi Republican Senator Roger Wicker.
I'll vote no on the pending resolution. President Trump decided to attack Iran. That decision was profound, deliberate, and correct.
44 Democrats and two independents voted to advance the war powers resolution, joined by Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul. That fell short of the 51 votes needed to pass. Georgia Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock spoke ahead of Wednesday's vote.
The declaration of war is not a power that the President of the United States has. The Constitution makes it clear the declaration of war is the authority and the responsibility of Congress.
Meanwhile, Politico reports some Democrats are not ruling out voting in favor of a multi-billion dollar infusion of new funding to the Pentagon. The White House is reportedly considering asking Congress for $50 billion in new funding, on top of $990 billion in military funding already approved by Congress in recent months. Sri Lanka's Navy says it's rescued 32 Iranian sailors and brought them to a hospital for treatment after an Iranian warship was torpedoed by a U.S. submarine in the Indian Ocean. Sri Lankan officials said they'd recovered 87 bodies from the ship's wreckage after it was struck without warning in international waters near Sri Lanka's coast. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth celebrated the attack on Wednesday.
An American submarine sunk an Iranian warship that thought it was safe in international waters. Instead, it was sunk by a torpedo.
Secretary Hegseth added, the U.S. and Israel are in the process of crushing Iran's government, quote, without mercy. Iran's foreign ministry says U.S. and Israeli attacks have struck 33 civilian sites across Iran, including hospitals, schools, residential areas, and historic sites. Earlier today, airstrikes destroyed Tehran's Zahedi Stadium, which has hosted international soccer matches. Meanwhile, two Iranian Red Crescent Society paramedics told Middle East Eye last weekend's bombing of an elementary school in southern Iran was a so-called double-tap airstrike, with the second strike coming after the school's principal called parents and told them to come and pick up their children. The strikes killed about 175 people, most of them young girls. Meanwhile, Iranian missiles reportedly targeted a base housing an Iranian Kurdish force in neighboring Iraq Thursday. The base is one of several where Iranian Kurdish separatists say they're preparing to launch an insurgency with U.S. backing against Iran's government. Iran is continuing to strike at U.S. military bases across the Middle East and the countries that host them. Iraqi forces say they shot down a drone targeting a U.S. base near Baghdad International Airport. Saudi Arabia's military says it intercepted and destroyed 10 drones and 2 cruise missiles. In Kuwait, an 11-year-old girl was killed when the remnants of a rocket hit her home. In the United Arab Emirates, 6 people were injured by falling debris from drones that were intercepted in the skies over Abu Dhabi. In Kuwait, an oil tanker anchored in the port of Mubarak al-Kabir reported a large explosion Wednesday, one of 5 ships in the region that reported attacks over the last 24 hours. Meanwhile, Azerbaijan says Iranian drones struck its territory Thursday, hitting an airport terminal and falling near a school building. 2 civilians were wounded. Azerbaijan summoned Iran's ambassador, demanding a clear explanation and threatening a response. Iran's foreign ministry later denied targeting Azerbaijan. Meanwhile, Iran's armed forces have denied firing any missile towards Turkish territory, after Turkey's military said a ballistic missile fired towards Turkish airspace was shot down by NATO and missile defense systems. Israel's military has ordered tens of thousands of additional residents of southern Lebanon to evacuate dozens of villages or face death. An Israeli military spokesperson posted a message in Arabic on X reading, quote, residents of southern Lebanon, you must move immediately to areas north of the Latani River. Unquote. Some 200,000 people live in the region. On Thursday, there were massive traffic jams as panicked residents piled personal belongings into cars and headed north. Meanwhile, Lebanon's health ministry says Israeli attacks have killed 8 more people across Lebanon, with several airstrikes overnight in southern Beirut. Beirut neighborhoods where Israel had issued forced evacuation orders. On Capitol Hill, a Marine Corps veteran suffered a broken arm as he was dragged out of a hearing by Capitol Police Wednesday after he disrupted a Senate hearing to protest the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. The veteran, Brian McGinnis, resisted as he was aggressively pulled by Capitol Police officers. Republican Senator Tim Sheehy of Montana joined the altercation. McGinnis's arm was broken after his hand became stuck in a doorframe. Elsewhere in Washington, D.C., demonstrators with the anti-war group Code Pink Thursday disrupted a Heritage Foundation conference protesting the think tank's role in crafting policies that boost military funding and support U.S. interventions overseas.
When they see a... When they see a flawless...
You stand up there talking about patriotism. You don't care about Americans. You don't care about your constituents. You care about that $500,000 in your pocket for APEC. Don't lie. Your constituents want health care and housing. They don't want to send their children to kill other children. They don't
want
their
money. Ladies and gentlemen, we live in the greatest country in the history of the world.
In climate news, new research suggests human activities causing ocean levels to rise far faster than government planners previously thought, with tens of millions more people at risk of losing their homes to rising seas. Researchers reviewed hundreds of scientific assessments, finding most of them underestimated baseline coastal water heights by 12 inches or 30 centimeters. A Texas Democratic Congress member warns there are at least 14 active measles cases at Camp East Montana, a hastily constructed tent camp in El Paso, where more than 3,000 immigrants are imprisoned. Another 112 people are being isolated. The ICE jail has recently had outbreaks of COVID-19 and tuberculosis and is rife with reports of inadequate medical care. Democratic U.S. Congress member Veronica Escobar warns the outbreaks threaten the greater El Paso community, yet she has never seen guards wearing masks to prevent the spread of highly infectious diseases. This comes as the Washington Post reports ICE is drafting a letter to terminate the facility's $1.2 billion contract. ICE dramatically cut its basic training program amidst a hiring spree meant to speed up the Trump administration's deportation efforts. That's according to records obtained by The Washington Post, which corroborate the claims of an ICE whistleblower who warned that ICE last year removed about 240 hours from its basic training program, or more than 40% of instructional time. On Wednesday, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem returned to Capitol Hill, where she was grilled by Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee about the killing of Renee Good and Alex Preti by federal agents. Once again, Noem refused to apologize for calling Good and Preti domestic terrorists almost immediately after they were shot dead. Meanwhile, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz appeared before the House Oversight Committee Wednesday, where he fended off charges from Republicans that he failed to prevent a social welfare fraud scandal, which the Trump administration used as a pretext to freeze Medicaid reimbursements to Minnesota. Walz said Minnesotans had been singled out and targeted for political retribution at an unparalleled scale.
Under the guise of combating fraud, the federal government has flooded Minnesota with masked, untrained, and unaccountable agents who are wreaking havoc in our communities. On the streets of Minnesota, federal agents have entered U.S. citizens' homes who have committed no crimes. They have violated the constitutional rights of our citizens. They have ignored court orders. They have shot first and asked questions later. Time and again, they have gaslit us by demanding that we ignore what we see before our very eyes. But the American people are not so easily fooled.
A massive blackout in Cuba has left most of the island, including Havana, without power. Cuban officials said the island's largest plant unexpectedly went offline. A U.S. oil blockade has cut off the Cuban government from accessing desperately needed fuel as the Trump administration intensifies pressure on Cuba. President Trump recently raised the possibility of a, quote, friendly takeover of Cuba, unquote. Meanwhile, Ecuador's expelled Cuba's ambassador and diplomatic staff, declaring them to be persona non grata. On Wednesday, Ecuadorian opposition lawmaker Hector Rodriguez criticized the move.
These kinds of measures undermine Latin America integration and undermine the possibility of having a union of neighboring countries that are brothers. We share a history and not only language and a cultural identity, but a way of seeing the world. Cuba and Ecuador have had relations for over 150 years.
Ecuador's decision to expel the Cuban diplomat came as the U.S. announced it had deployed special forces to Ecuador to conduct joint military operations with Ecuadorian commandos. Venezuela's interim president, Delcy Rodriguez, announced Venezuela will reform its mining laws in a move that will give the U.S. greater access to Venezuela's natural resources. Rodriguez made the announcement next to U.S. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum, who was in Caracas, along with executives from more than two dozen U.S. mining companies. Axios reports Trump officials have already brokered a massive U.S.-Venezuela gold deal. This all comes 2 months after the U.S. attacked Venezuela and abducted the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, and his wife, Celia Flores, who are currently in jail here in New York. The Republican-led House Oversight Committee has voted to subpoena U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi to testify about her handling of convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein's case. Meanwhile, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick has voluntarily agreed to testify. Last month, he admitted he and his family had traveled to Epstein's private island in 2012, contradicting earlier claims that he had cut off ties to Epstein in 2005. The House Oversight Committee has also asked Bill Gates, billionaire Leon Black, and Goldman Sachs departing general counsel Catherine Rumler to testify about Epstein. And a multi-year investigation into the Catholic Diocese of Providence, Rhode Island, has found Catholic priests sexually abused hundreds of children for decades and were protected by bishops who put the reputation of the church above the well-being of survivors. The report by Rhode Island's attorney general found 75 Catholic priests molested more than 300 victims since 1950, though the true number of victims and abusive priests is likely much higher. Only a quarter of those named in the report, or just 20 people, face criminal charges. Of those, just 14 were convicted. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, we speak to two former U.S. government officials who've spoken out against the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. Stay with us. By Kayla Painter. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. and Israeli attacks on Iran have entered a sixth day as the war spreads beyond the Middle East. In Iran, the U.S.-Israeli attacks have reportedly killed more than 1,230 people. According to the Iranian Red Crescent Society, the U.S. and Israel have struck at least 174 cities in Iran since Saturday. Iranian officials have accused the U.S. and Israel of intentionally striking civilian infrastructure, including schools, hospitals, and sports stadiums. Iran's continuing to retaliate across the Gulf. Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps claims it's inflicted significant damage on 20 U.S. military targets in Kuwait, Bahrain, and the UAE. Iran has been accused of firing drones and missiles at Azerbaijan and Turkey, but Iran denies both claims. On Wednesday, NATO air defenses shot down a ballistic missile headed into Turkish airspace. Earlier today, Iran's IRGC took credit for attacking a U.S. oil tanker in the Persian Gulf. This comes a day after a U.S. submarine torpedoed an Iranian naval vessel off the coast of Sri Lanka, killing at least 87 people. The ship had been returning from India, where it took part in a major international naval exercise called Milan 2026. The U.S. had been invited to take part in the same exercise, but pulled out. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi accused the U.S. Navy of committing an atrocity at sea. He said on social media, quote, "Mark my words, the U.S. will come to bitterly regret the precedent it has set," unquote. Meanwhile, the death toll from Israel's attacks on Lebanon has reached 77. More than 300,000 people have evacuated southern Lebanon. Earlier today, the Pentagon revealed the final two names of the six U.S. soldiers killed in an Iranian attack in Kuwait. On Wednesday, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth criticized how the news media has reported on U.S. troop deaths.
"We've taken control of Iran's airspace and waterways without boots on the ground. We control their fate. But when a few drones get through or tragic things happen, it's front page news. I get it. The press only wants to make the president look bad, but try for once to report the reality.
CNN's Caitlin Collins later questioned White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt about Hegseth's remarks.
The president is going to attend the dignified transfer for these families. Given what Secretary Hegseth said this morning, is it the position of this administration that the press should not prominently cover the deaths of U.S. service members?
No, it's the position of this administration that the press in this room and the press across the country should accurately report on the success of Operation Epic Fury and the damage it is doing to the rogue Iranian regime that has threatened the lives of every single American in this room.
If Hegseth was complaining that it was front page news about these six service members who were killed.
That's not what the secretary said, Caitlin, and that's not what the secretary meant, and you know it. You know you are being disingenuous. There is not. We've never had a secretary of defense. Who cares more?
Drones get through or tragic things happen. It's front page news. I get it. The press only wants to make the president look bad.
Yeah,
as you know, we cover the deaths of U.S. service members under every president.
The press does only want to make the president look bad. That's a fact. Especially you. No, listen to me. Especially you and especially CNN. And the Secretary of Defense cares deeply about our war fighters and our men and women in uniform.
This all comes as the Republican-led Senate rejected a resolution aimed to force President Trump to end the war in Iran, which was launched without congressional approval. Democratic Senator John Fetterman joined Republicans to oppose the war powers resolution. Republican Senator Rand Paul was the sole Republican to vote to curtail Trump's war powers. The House is scheduled to vote on a similar resolution today. We're joined now by two former U.S. government officials with long histories working on Mideast policy. Jasmine El-Gamal is the founder and CEO of Avera Strategies, foreign policy analyst and former Middle East advisor at the Pentagon during the Obama administration. She's joining us from London. Also with us, Hala Rarit. She's an 18-year career diplomat who resigned from the State Department over the Biden administration's Gaza policy. She was the first State Department diplomat to publicly resign. She had served as Arabic language spokesperson for the State Department. Rarit is now an IMEU Policy Project non-resident fellow joining us from Muscat, Oman, after evacuating from Dubai. Let's begin with you there, Hala Rarit. Explain what happened, why you have evacuated your family to Oman, and respond to what the U.S. has been doing over the last 6 days. We have entered the six-day mark for the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran, and then Iran retaliating throughout the Gulf.
Amy, it's such a pleasure to be back with you. I wish it was under better circumstances. But yes, like the rest of the world, I woke up on Saturday morning to the horrific news that the United States and Israel had attacked Iran. And I had the most sinking feeling, because this is exactly what American diplomats have been trying to avoid for two decades. And before my resignation, it is exactly what I was warning against and what I was trying to alleviate and was trying to stop. And it was just a horrific feeling knowing that the day had come and that this would absolutely not end well. When it comes to my family, I live in Dubai, as you mentioned, and I knew that the retaliation would come quickly. And so as a mother, I went into action mode as to what we needed to do to keep our family safe. Now, it did not take very long for the strikes to begin, and we could hear them very loudly in Dubai. Unfortunately, my kids were very frightened. We could hear the fighter jets, and we could also hear the interceptions. Now, luckily for the civilian population in Dubai, there's a robust missile defense system provided by the United States. Unlike, and I have to stress, the civilian population in Gaza that did not have the luxury of having a missile defense system or any type of defense system. So we were relatively safe, but for the sake of my children, we did not sleep. We had a sleepless night on Saturday because the noises were scaring them. And also we were getting these automatic updates. Whether your phone is on silent, the government was pushing out these very scary sounding that was really, really frightening to my kids. We were all in my bedroom. And after that, we knew, my husband and I understood, and I understood deeply as an American diplomat, that this situation would only escalate. So we decided on Sunday morning, as soon as we woke up, we hit the road to Oman, and I have been here since. Now we're in a bit of limbo, along with a lot of other American citizens, because the airspace is heavily restricted and it's very hard to get flights out. So for the time being, we're here and trying to figure out our next steps.
So there were indirect U.S.-Iran talks going on in Geneva that were facilitated by Oman's foreign minister, Badr bin Hamad al-Busaidi, key mediator in the U.S.-Iran nuclear talks. This was the foreign minister speaking to CBS Face the Nation this weekend.
The single most important achievement, I believe, is the agreement that Iran will never ever have a nuclear material that will create a bomb. This is, I think, a big achievement. This is something that is not in the old deal that was negotiated during President Obama's time. This is something completely new. It really makes the enrichment argument less relevant, because now we are talking about zero stockpiling. And that is very, very important, because if you cannot stockpile material that is enriched, then there is no way you can actually create a bomb, whether you enrich or don't enrich. And I think this is really something that has been missed a lot by the media, and I want to clarify that from the standpoint of a mediator.
So that's really interesting. Oman's foreign minister, Badr al-Busaidi, the key mediator in the U.S.-Iran nuclear talks, he flew from Geneva to Washington, D.C., apparently, word has it, to be able to directly convey to the president through the media to make sure that the president was not only getting the Witkoff, Jared Kushner version of the talks, but also to say you have a better deal than President Obama got back in 2015. I wanted to bring Jasmine El-Gamal into this conversation, former Middle East advisor to the Pentagon during Obama's administration. Your response to what has taken place?
Well, first of all, thank you so much, Amy, for having me on. I'm a big fan of the show, and it's really good to see Hala as well. I think, you know, there are really two big questions that any U.S. administration should have the answer to before it goes to war. One is, why are we going to war? Is this necessary? Have all other avenues been exhausted? That's one set of questions. And of course, the other one is, what are our objectives? Are they achievable? And what is our exit strategy? That's the second bucket of questions. And neither of those two buckets of questions have been adequately answered by the U.S. administration, by any official, whether it's Pete Hegseth at the Defense Department, Secretary Rubio, or the president himself.
So let's talk about the Trump administration's shifting rationales for why the U.S. attacked Iran amidst ongoing negotiations over Iran's nuclear program. So this is Secretary of State Marco Rubio speaking Monday.
We knew that there was going to be an Israeli action. We knew that that would precipitate an attack against American forces. And we knew that if we didn't preemptively go after them before they launched those attacks, we would suffer higher casualties and perhaps even higher those killed. And then we would all be here answering questions about why we knew that and didn't act.
On Tuesday, Rubio backtracked and said the decision to strike came from President Trump, not Israel. On Wednesday, White House Press Secretary Catherine Levitt said Trump had a, quote, good feeling Iran would attack.
I think the president, prior to that phone call, had a good feeling that the Iranian regime was going to strike the United States assets and our personnel in the region.
So, Jasmine El-Gamal, as a former Pentagon official, your characterization of these shifting reasons that the U.S. has attacked Iran?
I mean, it obviously shows you that there was no clear plan and no well-thought-out strategy before the U.S. entered into this war. Now, I don't want to remove all agency from President Trump. After all, he is the one who gave the order at the end. But we do know from extensive reporting from Hannah, and I am sure she can agree, from our time in government, that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been for decades trying to drag the U.S. into war with Iran. Senator Van Hollen yesterday said he just hadn't found a president stupid enough to be dragged into that war. So he was under, we know that President Trump was under heavy pressure from Prime Minister Netanyahu to strike.